Today, going nowhere fast. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. And I'm pleased to say that Tarek is back for another Friday chat. Hi, Tarek. Good to see you back.
Thanks, Martin. It's good to be back after a little bit of a hiatus. So, you know, there's plenty to get into this week. And, well, isn't there every week these days?
Well, there's plenty to talk about. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that... as the title says, we're really going nowhere very fast, right? So there's a lot of concerns about momentum, specifically relating, of course, to households. And so there's a lot to talk about. But before we do that, I should just say welcome back, and I hope the little one's fine.
Thanks for that. And I'd just like to say thank you to all the viewers who've sent, you know, messages of support, you know, who've tweeted, who've DM'd me, you know, even one or two who sent through some gifts for the little fella. It is very much appreciated, and I'm very glad to say that, you know, we took him in for another appointment today, and he's growing in a higher percentile than the Australian economy, let me put it that way.
That's a good way to put it. Yes, I'm afraid the Australian economy is looking pretty sick, and you know, as the new data comes in, it really, I think, focuses on inflation is more entrenched. We seem to be almost world beating at the moment with regard to the stickiness of inflation. Households are going backward at a great rate of knots in terms of real income. And of course, the old housing debt problem is bigger than almost any other country you can think about. So unfortunately, the settings that we've had over the last few years are really now coming home to roost.
They are. And I think that it's something really interesting has happened in the last, let's call it the last few weeks, maybe the last few months, but the last few weeks in particular. And I feel like we've sort of hit this critical mass of criticism being directed at Australia's current economic model. You know, there was a good article today from Alan Kohler in the AFR, basically, you know, what do you call it? You know, basically the banks and the federal government and the government and government in general were rigging the property market, driving it higher. And then you've got, you know, Jared Minnick, who I'm a really big fan of him going back a long time, you know, him saying that basically Australia's immigration-led economic growth model not only doesn't work, but is actively harming the outcomes that are being experienced by regular everyday Australians. And I think he makes a very, very important point. One, that yes, immigration has worked absolutely fantastically for Australia in the past from an economic perspective and from a social perspective. But when you take it to the extreme, it stops working from an economic perspective. And that's, I think, a very important point that really should be covered more, not only in you know, the media, which is, you know, something I think has really changed in recent months, but also in federal parliament, where it really needs to be discussed, I think.
Well, it does, I think. And it's interesting that Australia is not the only country with this problem. Canada, of course, has very high migration too. And in fact, yesterday the UK released their latest statistics, which were way higher. You know, more than 700,000 came into the UK, which is another world-beating number. So there's something broadly, you know, about with a lot of people mobile around the world. But the economic consequences for countries and individuals as a result of this, and frankly, because of the fact that until very recently, you know, big was better from a political and from an economic perspective. We're seeing now the consequences of that, and the consequences for people living in those countries, be it Canada, the UK, or Australia, are actually going backwards. You're getting a smaller share of the pie, even if the pie is growing a bit.
Yeah, exactly, 100%. Yes, we are seeing that, you know, decline in, you know, real household incomes, but I think more than that, that in the end, everyone is ending up having to pay for it in one way or another. Now, for example, say in Canada, the recent data from the Canadian Statistics Canada, their data came out and showed that rents were growing at the fastest rate since the inflationary period of the early 1980s. Now, That's a fairly significant problem for the Canadians, because they've already got a problem with entrenched inflation, and that could keep rates higher for longer. And there's no real sign of those rental pressures calming down on a, on a medium to long-term time horizon. So they're stuck in the same boat as Australia and the same boat as New Zealand. And I think that that's something that's sort of really needs to be rammed home about this, because it's not just renters who are going to suffer. It's going to keep inflation higher, which is going to feed into the prices paid by everyone, but it's also going to keep upward pressure on mortgage rates. So it's not just, the people at the rental end of the spectrum who are going to end up paying for this. It's mortgage holders as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting that more and more of the inflation momentum in Australia is now homegrown, thanks to high migration, therefore high rent growth, costs of housing, all of those things, plus, of course, the nonsensical gas pricing policy that they've got in Australia. And so, whilst the international supply chain issues are sort of curing themselves now, the stickiness of inflation in these countries, and it's all actually all driven by bad policy and high migration. So unfortunately, that means that interest rates are going to stay high for longer. Bullock pretty much gave that speech this week that said, hairdressers are having to charge more because they've got wages growth, because so it's sort of embedded now. And all of this, of course, as you say, comes back and puts more pressure on households with higher mortgages for longer. And I know that there are some people still arguing that the Reserve Bank will be cutting early next year, but I don't see it. I think it more likely we're going to see rates at their current levels or higher. And in fact, the RBA is projecting now into 2025 before they come back with an inflation ban, and how good their projections have been up to this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe you should put up that chart of the RBA's, bullish wages growth forecasts for years and years and years and years. I mean, so we do know they have form in that regard. But I think it's going to be interesting just to see how it all, plays out in the end, because Bullock said some interesting things that the AFR reported on. I think it was yesterday, and she talked about migration returning to normal,
Yep.
and about how that was going to impact the inflationary landscape. Now, obviously, normal is very much a matter of perspective, but if normal is what, the sort of most direct, obvious, candidate, which is pre-COVID levels, migration has a very, very, very long way to fall. And one wonders if the Albanese government does keep the hammer down. Now, I think migration is going to moderate somewhat, but that's something that's going to be in the future, because it takes time for these policies to feed through. But if migration does moderate, but it doesn't moderate as much, perhaps, as the Reserve Bank are anticipating or would like to see, then that could put further upward pressure on interest rates, or at the very least, keep pressure on the RBA to maintain rates where they are. So, reading between the lines a little bit there, I'm sort of, wondering if Bullock is sending the Albanese government a little bit of a message that, what do they say? Screw around and find out.
Yes, I think that's probably right. And of course, the RBA tends to be a little bit coy as to not wanting to intervene directly into some of the political agendas, though perhaps sometimes they should. And it's a bit like the productivity discussion from Phil Lowe when he was sort of saying, well, you need to find a way of getting greater productivity. And he also, I remember one of his appearances in front of, I think it was the Economics House Committee, House Economics Committee, he was giving the point about the fact that unless we actually are building property at a rate relative to migration, we're going to have a problem. So, that they have sort of signaled gently. I sometimes think that they're a little bit almost overcautious in terms of calling out some of these issues, because it seems to me that the problems we have in the housing market are directly linked back to the migration policy. The migration policy, which is, turn it up to 11 and just hope for the best and don't worry about building infrastructure or homes, it'll be all right. Well, clearly isn't. Which suggests that actually the migration issue is actually now the peak issue. And I'll be interested to see whether, in fact, the politicians come to the party or whether they will actually be continue to be influenced by Treasury, who only thinks about top line growth and GDP growth and more tax and all those things. And it's worth just saying, of course, that with inflation as strong as it is, and with wages growth a little stronger, Treasury will be celebrating increased tax take, So at the moment, you know, the tax bands are pretty much frozen. The tax take is higher. The tax take is higher also, of course, because we've got more people in the economy. But there's another interesting observation. I noticed that in the employment statistics this time around, there was a little note saying that the ABS were now going to start using the 2021 census data to adjust their calculations. Now, of course, the census data in 2021 is understating population growth by at least 500,000. So, you know, you'd have to say that maybe one of the reasons why the employment data is screwy is because, in fact, it's not caught up with the reality of migration in the last year or two.
Yeah, quite a few economists have made that point, that basically that the employment data should have, in all likelihood, deteriorated a bit more than it has. Now, I'm honestly not sure one way or another, but you know there is quite a strong argument in that regard. But I think the simple reality is, when it comes to the labor market, is if we continue to see the strong working age population growth as we've seen play out over the last 18 months, and that continues into the future, the ability for the labor market to keep up with that while rates are rising, while we're seeing the economy deteriorating, is, well, it's unlikely to continue. You know, we're already seeing trend unemployment up about, you know, sort of 0.2, 0.3%. While we're talking about small numbers now, if you start to see the economy deteriorate quite rapidly, unemployment is going to rise quite rapidly too. And the simple reality is when you see an economic downturn, unemployment doesn't rise slowly. It rises rapidly. And if you put that together with the migration aspect, it could get quite hairy in 2024 and 2025, depending on how things play out.
Absolutely. Well, of course, some of the other unemployment measures, like Roy Morgan, for example, is moving up. And I noticed that the job vacancies were a little bit more shaky too. So there are some leading indicators that would suggest that maybe the ABS is behind the eight ball. Still, I suppose we should get on with the old charts, seeing you've done a great amount of work putting the charts together. So let's go for it.
All right. As usual, ladies and gentlemen, the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. If you would like to have a look, usually the chart is sourced, if it's not by me, but this week most of them are. I would like to just say thank you to everyone who has subscribed, both paid and otherwise. It is very, very much appreciated. And if you would like to subscribe or to support my work, you can do so with a link in the description or the URL right there. So we'll get right into this week's charts. Now, this one did the rounds on Twitter and was very popular. This is from the report by Jared Minack, which is what I was referencing earlier. And basically it shows the median national house price as a ratio against nominal GDP per capita. Now, this I think is a really nice way of just deflating all the various issues and removing some of the distortions that you see. And basically it shows that for the longest time, housing prices have been within a relatively narrow range, with the exception of the time around the Second World War, which was distorted by price controls, etc. But you take that out of the equation, it's sort of been somewhere between 6 and 7 times nominal GDP per capita for, well, a century. And then if you see that circled in the red there, that is the Howard's doubling of the first homeowners grant and also the introduction of the capital gains tax discount. Now, there are naturally other factors at work during that period, but it was arguably, you know, two of the main catalysts during that limited period that helped prices really take off. And I think it just goes to show how disconnected prices have become from the broader economy.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? And I guess a couple of questions that come to mind. Of course, the GDP has been very strong, particularly in recent years, because of the the mining boom and all of the exports to China. So the GDP number is bigger. So to what extent does that actually shape these numbers, or would it actually make them worse if, in fact, the GDP hadn't grown as much?
That's part of the problem. You know, if you were to deflate this against household income per capita, I think that it would likely look even worse. Because I mean, the thing is that if you look, say for example, that sideways period in the late 2000s and the early 2010s, that's down to the mining boom. Even though during the latter part of that period, housing prices were going to the moon, and then part of the consolidation again, it lat in the latter part of the 2010s is the takeoff of the LNG export boom, which also added to GDP. So perhaps a better chart would be, as I said, median house price versus nominal household disposable income per capita. But I don't have housing prices going back that far, unfortunately. Although I do have them going back to the 70s, so perhaps I'll put together that chart, and that's something that we can look at a later date.
I think it will be very interesting because certainly my analysis suggests that the ratio is even worse when you actually go down that route rather than the GDP route, because the GDP route is protected because of the massive growth in GDP relative to previous because of the the mining boom. But whichever way you look at it, Houston, we have a problem.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, it as well is if this is what it looks like without, with some favorable distortions, what does it look like without it?
Yeah.
And the thing is that, most Australians don't really see the benefit from the mining and the LNG boom, to a degree, sure, but I'll put together the chart and we'll see what it says.
And I think you'll probably find that we'll be about 40 to 45% over the long-term trends now, if you look at it from an income perspective. So my calculations quickly have been that house prices are 40% over where they were from a long-term perspective. Because of all the changes, because of the demand, because of low interest rates, because of the loose lending, all of those things, and because of the migration, all of those things are driving it. And this is a structural issue. This isn't just a sort of a bubble. This is a real big structural issue.
I think you make an important point because I think it's easy to just say, oh, it's X, oh, it's Y, issue or driver or whatever. But I think the reality is that it's a lot of different things. It is migration. Depending on the level of migration, it is all these different things all feeding into the calculation. Tax concessions, demand, psychology, the impact of the introduction of the block. Now that sounds like a joke, but it's actually not. But you get the naturally you get the point, and it all basically comes down to this this big seesaw effect on one side, and if you keep seeing things being tilted in one direction, then obviously prices are going to rise, and if you see things tilted in the other direction, prices are going to fall. So I think that's one of the things at the moment, say for example with the impact of migration, that's really key, that prior to migration increasing to record high levels, the market was tilted to the downside. You were seeing prices falling across most locales, and that was just the balance of the market and the way everything worked out at the time. And then obviously you whack the weight on the other side, and up she goes. And now we're starting to see the impact of that run out and that balance shift again. So I think that it's a constantly evolving thing, and just trying to attribute it to one thing or two things individually, well, it doesn't work because it's just everything in concert. Like they could, for example, remove negative gearing tomorrow and keep migration high, and obviously that would affect the balance dramatically.
No, that's exactly right. It's a complex system, and that's why it's difficult to be able to sort of unpick individual pieces of policy and blame negative gearing or first-time buyer incentives, But the fact is that those actually have a positive impact. Things that might have a negative impact would be higher interest rates and tighter lending standards. But it's all about those shifting sands. But if you stand back and look at it, over the longer term period, as this chart does, it shows you that we are have departed from a long-term medium path to an extreme position. And so the question is, will that extreme position stick, or will it ultimately revert back to, a more normal path? And that for me is the really interesting question, because if it reverts to a normal path, then you're talking about significant home price value falls. If we can keep it stuck at this level, And, you know, I'd argue that we're running the machine at 110% or more, you know, a bit like Star Trek, you know, push those engines a bit further. But the question is, can you push those engines even further without something breaking?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, as we've discussed previously, I think it just comes down to what are you willing to throw on the fire? You know, like if you look at it from a purely sort of hypothetical, you know, devil's advocate, I have absolutely no soul and I don't give a shit about anyone. Yeah, you can. You can throw super on the fire. You can throw more tax dollars on the fire. You know, you can spend, you know, $50 billion a year on first homeowner grants and just keep sending that thing to the moon. You know, it's possible. But I think the question is slowly becoming what is the trade-off of that? You know, like I think we're going to start to see that, say, for example, with the debate around negative gearing. And I think we're going to start to see proposals coming in from different parts of the political sphere rather than just the Greens and the left of Labour. But even, say, for example, from within the Liberal Party, trying to short circuit a larger change by proposing something in the here and now. Well, perhaps not the here and now, but in the next couple of years, that sort of just goes, well, we'll just limit it to one or to two or to X deduction or Y deduction. So it ends up, you know, sort of directing the attention elsewhere. And because I think that housing is going to become an increasingly important issue, because it's all well and good for people to say, oh, well, you know, millennials and Gen Z aren't doing too bad. But I think it's about one, what sort of quality house are they getting relative to their parents, you know, and you know, relative to what they would have got, say, you know, 20 years ago. And it's also how are they achieving that? You know, it's all well and good to say, oh, well, we've seen an uptick in the number of millennials buying a house, but if you look at DFA's data, you also see the fact that the people buying houses, a large proportion of them are doing it with the bank of mum and dad or the bank of grandma and grandpa. So, you know, you're seeing those people who have the affluence getting in while others get left behind.
Yes, and of course you can't completely take the political angle off the table. You know, Queensland doubling the first owner grant, right, recently. There's a political thing. That's nothing to do with about economics or housing. It's a political signal. And so, to my mind, the problem we've got here is that this housing debate is contaminated by a set of political dynamics that actually get in the way sometimes.
I agree. And that's the Queensland First Homeowner Grants is something that we're going to get to later on in the slides.
Excellent.
Okay. Now, I really like this chart because it shows household disposable income growth over the last decade and a decade before that, and so on and so forth, all the way back to the 1980s. Now, most recently, over the last 10 years, real household disposable income per capita has gone backwards. In previous cycles, it's risen between 10 and 26%. But I didn't think that chart was quite complete, so I added to it. I also added household disposable income growth per capita over the decade, but in non-inflation adjusted terms. Now, I think this shows nicely that, say, for example, in the period between 1983 and 1993, real household disposable income growth was actually relatively low compared with the decades that would come ahead, but in nominal terms, it was actually even higher. Now, while that doesn't help you buy more stuff at the supermarket or to buy a car or whatever, what it does do is it deflates the cost of your debt and it helps you pay down that mortgage faster and for that mortgage to take up a smaller proportion of your income, which in turn helps you to spend more.
That's a very, very important insight, and it's something that I've been pushing on about for some time, about the fact that the debt burden has been building and building and building, and the income growth has not been there to deflate the pressure of that debt. And you know, we're seeing now more people going into retirement with bigger amounts of debt. We're seeing the mortgages a lot bigger than they were. And because of that low income growth, the real pressure on households over the medium and long term are huge, which means, of course, they've got less disposable income to spend on other things.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, both of those factors are why we have seen such, well, such poor income growth and also such poor economic outcomes. You know, it's all well and good to say, oh, but unemployment's low, oh, but this, oh, but that. But at a household level, people aren't any better off based on these metrics than they were a decade ago. They're actually slightly worse off. And, you know, I think that that's quite a profound failure, you know, and a profound change. And I think it's all well and good for people who, you know, who experienced other eras to say, oh, well, it's not as bad as X, Y, and Z. And perhaps it's not. It's very much a matter of perspective, what you experienced as an individual. But in terms of the protracted nature of this economic blow, you'd be hard pressed to find another one outside of the war or the depression in Australian history. And from that particular perspective, the duration of it's unprecedented, as I said, in the post-war period. So I think that really needs to be taken into account. And it's also the fact that there's no real light at the end of the tunnel. This isn't going to get any better anytime soon.
Yeah, the other observation, if you actually overlay their tax take over the top of that, the disposable income. So I calculate disposable income after tax, to be able to actually understand how much money people actually have. And if you do that after tax, because of course the tax take's gone up because of those fixed tax bands and things. What it means is that the average disposable income that people are having to spend on the mortgage or the rent is just going up. And there are people now at 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60% of disposable income on housing. And that shows you just how significant the pressure, the burden on households who are having to spend either rent or mortgage on getting somewhere to live. And it shows you again, it goes back to that other chart, if the ratios are so adverse, then this is the consequence. And all the settings are just wrong in terms of actually how people can get out of this.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, on one side of the fence, you've got, you know, elements of the Liberal Party who say that low wage growth is a feature of their policy making, and then on the other side of the fence, you've got the Albanese government who says that they're all about trying to get wage growth going and getting wages moving and all that stuff, but then they take policy steps like increasing migration so significantly, which then puts downward pressure on wages. So I mean, I think that the settings are basically just broken.
Yes, I agree. And by the way, going back to the UK briefly, they are looking at a £50 billion, I should say, increase in tax take over the next few years, simply because of they've also frozen the tax bands as well. And they gave a little bit back in the mini budget, but most of it is being taken through just more tax. So, the proportion of tax that's being paid by ordinary people in the UK and Australia have almost never been higher, maybe than other than during the Second World War.
Well, it's all part of the same playbook, isn't it? They're all running the same thing. I mean, if you look at the tax brackets here in Australia, say you compare, like, you know, 20, 2015, 2016, and now, they're really not that different, you know,
Correct.
despite 7 years of inflation.
Yep. And very strong inflation at that.
Oh, in recent years, absolutely. Now, this is a chart that was requested by a viewer a while ago. I think it was actually a few months ago now, and I finally got the data and I finally got around to doing it. I'm sorry, but I forgot who requested it. But it is the ratio between outstanding mortgage debt and borrowing for businesses. Now, in the late 1980s, the number it, there was about 40 cents worth of mortgage debt for each dollar borrowed by business. So that was pretty good. You saw, you know, almost two and a half, you know, roughly 2.5 times more cash flowing to businesses than flowing to mortgages. And obviously that helped power Australia's manufacturing sector. It helped, you know, it helped b build many businesses now that are the backbone of the Australian economy, both big, you know, big ends from big businesses down to small businesses. Whereas today, there's more than $2 outstanding worth of mortgage debt that for every dollar lent to businesses. So we've completely flipped the script in that regard. And, you know, this, I think, just shows one of the reasons why Australia has become such an unproductive economy in terms of its productivity growth, in terms of its innovation, and just in terms of, you know, a lot of people, a lot of very, very smart people taking their business ideas elsewhere where they can get the capital to, you know, make their dreams come true and, you know, create, you know, these amazing, vibrant businesses.
Yeah, this is a very important chart, and it's one I've been banging on about for some time because the ratio has flipped from where it was to where it is. And basically, what we have is we have our big banks that are basically just big building societies. You know, they're just throwing money at the housing sector, and of course, it's driven partly by the Baal calculations for capital because it's actually cheaper for banks to lend mortgages rather than to businesses. And from my business surveys, I know that many businesses just can't get the credit that they need to be able to grow their businesses, or if they do, they have to put their house up, and then they actually also still pay significantly high price in terms of the costs of that finance. So it is really difficult. And as you say, a result of that is you get a brain drain. You get people saying it's too hard in Australia to create a business. I'm going to somewhere else where I can create it more effectively. The whole question of what is the nature of the economy in Australia, right? You know, it's houses and holes, basically. And part of the reason is this, because you cannot actually get the financing for business investment and business growth. And that means that productivity continues to languish. It means that we have less innovation. All those things follow from that.
Indeed, and I think the thing is that we're basically just stuck in this, you know, this terminal decline in term in that regard, because unless the settings change, things are not going to, you know, the course isn't going to change. You know, we're going to keep on this path of relying on housing, which is going to lead us to a more narrow and narrow economy with, you know, larger and larger proportions of the population in serious debt, or saving up to have a house and then having serious debt. And that's no good for businesses. It's no good from the corner shop all the way up to, you know, the mega stores at the local super center. So, you know, I just think we're hollowing out the economy in that regard, and it's, you know, we're sort of stuck on this path until the settings changed. And, you know, I mean, either they change because of some form of economic shock, or they change because things have just deteriorated so badly that there's no other option than to change them. Although, you know, given the vested interests and their and the influence that they wield in Parliament, that's probably going to take a while.
Yeah, it is worth reflecting, of course, that about half of the economic activity in Australia is actually consumer spending. So if consumer spending gets squeezed because of this mechanism that we're seeing, and you know, more people are chasing houses and having to spend more of their income on houses, so they have less disposable income left, that's going to be another economic drag. And what it means is that the economy gets even more and more distorted, because the only thing that actually is driving positive momentum is LNG, minerals, and a couple of other things, and maybe a bit of education, and maybe a bit of you know, holidaymakers coming to Australia. Such a narrow base, and in fact, you'll know that the statistics have shown that we've got one of the narrower based economies in the world, and that narrow base means that we're more likely to topple if one of those other things go off the agenda. So this should be a wake up call, but actually, you know, the banks quite like it because mortgage lending is cheap and safe. Their losses are very, very low. If they lent more to business, they probably have higher losses.
Well, you know, I, at the end of the day, as far as I'm concerned, it's up to government policy to shift the needle to you know, to put, you know, I mean, what is it, you know, Charlie Munger, you know, show me the incentive and I'll show you the results. And that's what they have to do. They have to incentivize the right outcomes. And, you know, right now they're incentivizing, you know, giving, you know, $8 billion in tax concessions to people to lose property on property every year. So, you know.
And just going back to the migration, because of this economic conundrum that we've got, migration is the sort of the simple answer, right? Because from a top line growth perspective, from a treasury perspective, you increase the numbers, that means you increase the tax take, increases the momentum in the economy. So you can actually mask a lot of this through high migration. So in a way, the migration solution is the lazy solution.
No, that's exactly what Jeremy Minax said. So, You're in good company in that regard, my friend. Okay, now this is the latest chart from CBA on the breakdown of spending by age demographic. And basically, if you're under the age of 40, your spending is falling in overall terms. And the older you get, the more your spending is growing. So, I think that this just goes to show that really the traditional drivers of the consumer economy, which is, the 18 to 49, 25 to 54 age demographics, they've really all but flamed out. And it's worth noting that this is in nominal terms. Once you adjust it for inflation, these numbers look awful.
Yeah, very, very compelling that data, and it's consistent with what I'm seeing in my surveys too. That there are some segments that are still doing very well. They don't have the debt. They don't have the big rents. They've also, of course, got assets. Those assets now, particularly if they've got money in the bank or other investments, are actually paying quite good returns. So they've actually got quite good incomes. That means that they can spend quite freely, and that's why there's a bit of a boom in cruise ships, so taking trips on cruises and those sorts of things. So there are categories of spending which is actually aligned to those older age groups that are very strong. But if you look at it more broadly across the economy, my data and this data marries up remarkably well. Younger people are actually up against it, and for all the reasons we've discussed, really.
I don't really have anything to add to that, but so it's quite a good sum up.
Good.
Okay. Now, there is a lot of debate about whether or not we have enough construction workers here in Australia. And we actually have one of the highest numbers per capita in the entire developed world. If not, I think there are maybe one or two other nations who have higher, but Australia is one of the highest. And we also build one of the highest levels of new homes per capita in the developed world as well. Even yet, if you have a look, I recently went through the ABS data and I made this. This is a chart of the number of new home completions per year per construction worker employed in the building game. And as you can see, it peaked in 1994. Now, this is usually where someone chimes in and says, aha. But homes are larger than they were in 1994. Yes, that is correct. They are larger. But there's also more apartment construction going on. So if you're talking about the average size of a new home, overall home being either an apartment, townhouse, or a new house, the numbers are actually relatively similar overall. Now, there's obviously issues with complexity, but then on the other side, other hand, on the other side of the coin, there's also the fact that people have things like mobile phones and cordless power tools and the proliferation of all these other different forms of technology. But overall, the number of homes being built per tradie actually employed in building has fallen significantly. Now, it's worth noting that part of that fall is driven by the impact of the pandemic. So you could probably disregard just the last little tail of that chart, but it's still in a profound downtrend. And I think that that is something that really needs to be focused on as we try to fix this housing issue that we have in this country, that efficiency is a problem. And this isn't just an ivory tower, white collar worker perspective on this. If you get out there and you talk to tradies on building sites, they will t and ask them, are you being used efficiently? Could you get, could you do a better job? Could you get more work done if you weren't hamstrung by X, Y, and Z? And a lot of them will tell you, oh God, yes.
Yeah, I know a number of builders who would say that they used to be able to build quicker, faster, and more effectively. And some of it's to do with the regulatory environments that are now in place. Some of it's to do with the specialization that there now is. So, you need to be licensed to do this, and then this, and then this, and then this. Whereas if you go back a couple of decades, you as a builder, you could do pretty much everything. So that's part of the issue too. I guess one other question with this particular chart: those building workers are not necessarily just in home construction, are they? Are they all workers in the building and construction
all
sector?
All workers, all builders across across the board. Yeah. However, it is worth noting that Alex Joyner from IFM made a good chart that shows that the number of people directly employed in building houses has doubled in the last decade. Yep. But we certainly haven't doubled the number of houses being built.
Yeah, because I was going to say, there's been a big infrastructure bulge, particularly because of government spending in the last decade or so as well. So there's actually a sort of competition for those building and construction workers. But I was going to make the point that you just made, that actually, if you look at it from a number perspective, there are more people building houses or building apartments or building other places to live today than we've ever had. And of course, there's a recent debate from a big CEO of a building company saying, well, you should just focus on migrating more building construction workers to come to Australia to build the houses that we need to support the people who are actually migrating to Australia, which I thought was a nice recursive comment, really.
Well, my question in all of this, right, about skilled migration and all that, is if we've been running one of the world's largest skilled migration programs as a proportion of our population for the best part of almost 20 years now, why do we still have skill shortages? How do we not have enough tradies, enough doctors, enough nurses, enough, everyone knows the quality of life Australia can provide in relative terms. Mm. Everyone knows how appealing it is. Why do we have that problem? And the answer of the Labor Party, admittedly, which is correct, is we've been running the immigration program wrong. Yeah, you have.
Yeah.
But are they going to fix it? Do you think they're going to fix it to the point where we're not going to have skills shortages?
Mm.
Well, we'll see.
Ask Bob the Builder. Will he fix it?
Okay. Now this is of an analysis that Bloomberg did recently. It's admittedly a rather limited sample size, but basically Australia has one of the lowest rental vacancy rates amongst its peers in the world. So, yeah, I think that pretty much speaks for itself. That is why we have such a profound rental crisis. And to be honest, I was actually taken a little bit by surprise that Canada is actually slightly better. It's still completely horrible, it's worth noting, but on this particular metric, Canada is faring slightly better at a national level.
It is interesting because in the UK, they're talking very vociferously about the lack of rental availability. And, their number's higher, as you say. Australia is chronic, absolutely chronic. And that's why rentals are still rising and the cost of rent going through the roof, as the latest statistics show. And, of course, availability is nowhere. And just to remind everybody, the rent and the lift in rent feeds into the inflation number. So this has a direct impact on locally homegrown inflation in Australia.
Yep. Cue the Benny Hill music.
Exactly.
Okay, this is from The Economist. Now, this was originally a table, so I just put together this chart because I thought it was a little bit better of an illustration. And basically, it takes five different metrics, core inflation, inflation expectations, and a number of other different metrics, and basically works out a score on how entrenched the good folks at The Economist believe inflation is. And Australia won the gold medal yet again. So, golf clap for Australia there. We apparently have, according to The Economist, some of the most entrenched inflation in the developed world.
Yeah, entrenched meaning that it's sticky, meaning it's going to be hard to actually cure. And I suspect it also means that it's more homegrown rather than actually just supply chain, international supply chain.
Oh, so we're disagreeing with Albo? Is that what we're doing?
Yes. We are actually more agreeing with the RBA, who again said we've actually got more locally homegrown inflation now. So yeah. The RBA said it.
Oh, 100%. I mean, to be honest, on that front, I've actually been very impressed with Bullock, and kudos to her. I hope she keeps it up.
Absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
Here we get to the Queensland government's doubling of the first homeowner grant to $30,000, and it includes granny flats. How exactly that works, I don't know. I've asked the Queensland government for clarification, and guess who's still waiting for clarification? This guy. So we'll see exactly what that actually means. But the reason why, one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up is because of the chart we've got here on the left. That is the quarterly change in the new home price component of the CPI. Now, recently, against, some expectations, that bottomed and has bounced. Now, this grant from the Queensland government and also the ongoing issues with the, in some cases, the scarcity of builders has now put further upward pressure on the new home price component of the CPI and broader inflation. And it's worth noting that the new home price component is the single largest sub-index of the entire CPI. So if this is above trend, if this is above the RBA's target range, if this is, sort of 3.5, 4%, and you've got rents running at 9, 10, 11, 12%, it's going to be very, very difficult to get inflation down in a timely fashion.
Yeah, and I was going to say, this is what I would have cued the Benny Hill music, because this is ridiculous. Completely ridiculous, right? So let's solve the problem by actually throwing more money into this. The Productivity Commission, other analysts around the world have said these grants don't help the problem. They actually exacerbate the problem. Why? Because they actually create more demand, house prices go up, and as you say, feeds directly into inflation. So this is a political thing. This is nothing to do with solving anything to do with housing affordability. And it could actually increase the probability of higher interest rates for longer.
Absolutely. And the ironic thing is that this could just see parents building granny flats in their backyard for their kids and ergo not add anything to broader housing supply. And it's just a $30,000 or $60,000 or $90,000 free kick. I mean, I don't know if that's going to be viable or not. It's unclear as to what exact how exactly that's going to work. But I just think that, it's a short-sighted policy. And if that sort of silly scenario I just mentioned is possible, well, that's a whole lot less tradies working, building new homes for actual first home buyers in Queensland and just building in people's backyards and building granny flats. So that's a capacity issue. That's an inflation issue. It's a rental availability issue. It's just a mess.
Yeah, and CoreLogic and a couple of other entities published a report some time ago. I think they went across the country and identified more than 600,000 places where you could actually plant a granny flat in the grounds of a property, right? And their argument was, oh, granny flats is a way to solve one of the ways to solve the housing problem. Now, just a couple of observations. Of course, no one's talking about the extra impost in terms of water, power, and other utilities and services. Every time you sort of put another thing on the ground, you've actually got to connect it up, right? And the second is, as you say, it doesn't solve the fundamental structural issue that we've been talking about. It's just another, well, it's a bit of sticking plaster trying to solve a problem that's going to create a bigger problem. And by the way, the quality of the construction of those granny flats and the longevity, I question. It's quite easy to throw something up quickly and cheaply, but is it going to be actually well insulated and good quality? And will it actually, work? And does it solve the problem? No, it doesn't.
Yeah, sometimes I see the quality of these builds and I'm just like, well, and this is something I spoke to about, spoke to Edwin about the other day. I think you'd be better off with just a couple of sh shipping containers, some welding equipment and just go on hand, really. I mean, you could do worse.
You could do a lot worse. Absolutely, you could.
Okay, now eagle-eyed viewers will note that I posted this chart before. It was seen a couple of weeks ago. This is of the Domain Rental Price Index. Well, actually, it's technically of the rental price index that I put together from their numbers because they don't actually have one. But anyway, it's basically done using the same weights as SQM's numbers. So, I just put that together. And basically it shows that it tracks that the CPI is tracking the domain index pretty well. Or just with a bit of a with an 18-month lag. So we're still quite a ways away from the peak in inflation. But the thing that I have to add is this next chart. This is what the domain rents looks like at a capital city level over the next 18 months. Now, if it continues to track that, we could be looking at rental price inflation exceeding 14%. Now, personally, I'm not sure that we're quite going to get there just because of, how rents are measured within the CPI. But, and then on the other hand, you've got Governor Lowe talking about 10, 10 and a half sort of percent inflation. Personally, I'm seeing around, personally, I'm estimating, admittedly, this is a sort of bit of a Barnackian sort of guess, around about a peak of around about 12 and a sort of, CPI higher for longer sort of thing. But either way, rents still have quite a bit higher to go.
Yeah, and you mentioned they're low. Did you mean low or do you mean Bullock?
No, low, low.
Okay. Yeah. Because of course that was what that was then. There's been no commentary from the RBA that I've seen that actually has updated any of those thoughts with regard to the impact of rents on the inflation.
Well, perhaps Bullock doesn't think that that's as much her purview to be speaking on such things that are influenced so much by federal policy, perhaps.
That's what I wondered. Yes. In the early days, maybe she's got the training wheels on. So we'll see.
Well, I mean, in fairness, Lowe probably was pushing the envelope of what is possible in that regard. And to be completely frank, that's one of the things that I'm going to remember fondly about the guy.
Absolutely.
He was on the ball about rents, about productivity, about the impact of migration on wages, and he stuck his neck out on those. And while I think he made a lot of mistakes, probably more a lot more mistakes than he did in terms of on balance, but I gotta respect the guy for that, and I only hope that Bullock and his and her successors end up living up to his example on that particular point, because it's a tough thing to do.
Well, that's right, because there's no other entity that has the ability potentially to highlight these issues in the same way. So let's hope that they do continue to push on these, the productivity question, the housing and rental question, because they are fundamental. And as we keep coming back to, the reason it's so important is because it does feed directly into what happens to inflation going forward.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we see the CPI adjusted in the right sort of direction, you put this together with new home rents, you could be talking, sorry, new home prices, we could be talking about 15% of the CPI right then and there. And that's a fairly significant, sort of chunk of change right off the bat. So, and that could have an outsized impact on the rest of the CPI.
Yeah, spot on, because of course it's a feedback and it's a reinforcing sort of loop, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, this chart has certainly changed a bit, because I've been producing this chart now for, well over a year now, and Kiwi housing prices continue to bounce, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately. And it seems that all you have to do is impose misery on millions and millions of people, and you too can put a floor under housing prices by using a rental crisis.
Yes, it's a lever. And I don't know whether you saw, but CoreLogic from New Zealand published their pain and gain report recently, and they actually showed that there's been a spike in recent for sales or home sales. So, a lot of people are actually selling now, just held probably for a couple of years and they're having to sell. It's higher in Auckland than elsewhere, and the numbers are up. And people are actually, if they've bought recently and they're having to sell, are underwater. But there are still a lot of other people who are selling and still have made significant gains. So it's an interesting observation. But this is a really concerning story, because what it says is that you can actually sacrifice, well, a considerable proportion of the population to save the housing market.
Exactly. I mean, they ran out of levers to pull, at the time, and they pulled the last one that they had available to them, and they pulled it hard.
Absolutely.
And they've done that in the UK, they've done that in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, they've all done the same thing, to varying degrees. And we've seen similar results. Although I will note that the Canadian housing price recovery looks to be running like it's running out a bit of gas.
Yeah.
So, they saw an additional set of rate rises. So I wonder if we see another one or two here in Australia, if we could possibly follow the same path. I mean, looking at the, say, for example, looking at the Sydney auction market, I think that we're reaching, roughly that sort of equilibrium point of, you know, of a balance. And that's something that I talked about recently with Louis Christopher from SQM, and you know, he broadly concurs with that particular perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although I wouldn't, you know, don't hold your breath, but it could well be that we're going to see more government intervention, particularly state government intervention. You know, another first owner grant here, another thing there. You know, think about the political cycle. When are the next elections coming? You know, we've got to be seen to be doing things to help first time buyers. There are still plenty of shots in the locker.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like I said, there are plenty more hopes and dreams to be thrown on the fire. I know that sounds a little bit dark, but unfortunately, it also happens to be accurate.
Spot on. I agree, and that's the problem. Yeah. So unless we get those some of those structural changes that we touched on earlier on, this has a worrying sense that it could perpetuate and just get more and more distorted, which is not good for anybody, really, apart from politicians, possibly.
No. Wow, yeah. And who else matters? Okay, now this is a chart of floor space started in for the Chinese real estate sector on the left and floor space sold. Now, I was looking at this earlier today and I came to a rather simple but obvious but also important conclusion that Chinese developers are starting less space now than they are selling by a significant margin, somewhere around about 20 million square meters a month. And I realized that they're doing this for a very good reason. They're doing this to build a backlog of projects to basically create a glide path down of in the level of activity rather than just building whatever they could and then just ending up hitting a brick wall when that pipeline expires. So this, I think, is a very much a time buying exercise, but also at the same time an acknowledgement that this adjustment is only just beginning. They are preparing for a long haul, you know, for this to continue on for a long, long time until the adjustment is finally complete. And I think, you know, well, judging by that, you know, that floor space sold chart, that's going to take a while.
That's an astonishing piece of analysis. Well done on that. And it's interesting. Did you see that? You know, the Chinese government was saying, "Well, we're going to provide, you know, some appropriate support for the construction sector if we need to as we go forward." So there is a little bit of an orchestration going on here, I think, to try and, as you say, create a glide path rather than just a cliff. But the net of this, well, they're going to need less resources, less imports potentially, and that could have an
Yep.
interesting impact on some of the Australian exports.
Exactly. I mean, I think the thing is at the moment, looking at the level of construction activity, we're down somewhere around about 15 to 16%, depending on the metric you're using. So it's down relatively profoundly, but the reality is that it's not down by as much as, say, for example, the floor space started chart on the left there, which basically just shows that it's, you know, the amount of space started has collapsed by over 60%. Now, it hasn't collapsed by that much. You know, starts haven't dropped that much, and that they, you know, and we're a long, long way away from, you know, sort of the roughly, you know, 50 to 60% drop in sales. So there's a long, long way to fall, but for the time being, at least. The additional expenditure on infrastructure projects, the additional expenditure on, you know, say for example, into expanding manufacturing, expanding things like shipbuilding, etc., is managing to keep steel demand at a relatively high level. It's you know, far more robust than a lot of analysts, including myself, thought it would be. But as the level of activity falls off, and as this pipeline of projects is slowly but surely depleted, eventually it's going to get to the point where, for a reasonable price, they are not going to be able to fill that gap with more infrastructure or other forms of projects, particularly with the local government debt issues.
Spot on, absolutely. And then these things have a habit of working out not over weeks, but months and years, right? So it's important to take a bit of a longer term view than just saying, "Oh, well, next week it's going to all change again," right? This is a structural issue.
Oh, 100%. And I think that, that the glide path is important because it shows that they're relatively committed to this. Now that could change. They could panic, they could do a stimulus. I think that's always a possibility on the horizon. But if the current sort of paradigm continues in China, if we do see that glide path, we continue to see activity in the real estate sector decline, what is Australia going to do? If you're talking about, sort of what about 40% or more of the iron ore flowing into China flows into the construction, the real estate construction sector, and you're talking about activity level roughly halving. Now, yes, there are other things you can do in order to offset that, but I don't think that can be offset in its entirety, particularly if you do see a deceleration in infrastructure growth, because they can't keep spending this amount of money forever and ever, infinitum. There are debt issues, there are other problems. I mean, you're even seeing some provinces cancel, basic bus and transport services because they're so far up the creek. So how is this going to play out for Australia in the long term? And it doesn't really look that great, particularly if you do start to see some of those Chinese mines in places like West Africa actually come to fruition. Now, admittedly, that is, the biggest possible question mark, one would imagine.
Yeah, big questions, of course, but there are more significant reasons. I just go back to what we said earlier on about the narrow base of the Australian economy. Well, if in fact that steel demand tails off, then that has a very significant impact on the overall budget and on the GDP and everything else, which then says, well, okay, another set of exposures then for the Australian economy.
100%. And I think it's worth just noting as well, just something very briefly, that the income that the Australian government actually does very, very well out of the mining sector. Very well, to the tune of, I believe the last numbers I read were somewhere between 50 and 60 billion a year to state and federal authorities just from the mining sector. Now, they do decently out of the gas sector, they do pretty well, but it's nowhere near as much as the mining sector. And even as LNG ramps up, because there's been such huge capex, because there's been losses, all these different things over the years, the LNG boom is not going to benefit Australia in the same way, in anywhere near the same way as the mining boom has.
Spot on, absolutely right. And the other thing, of course, about the LNG, the price of LNG, if it goes up, feeds back directly into energy prices in Australia because of the way that the energy market works, which is another inflationary force. So there you go. Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
You gotta love that, don't you? That was such a silly, silly thing to do. But I mean, it's on brand though, isn't it?
I was going to say there is a consistent pattern when you stand back and think about it. There is a consistent pattern of stuffing up majorly.
Yeah, and being short-sighted and not thinking about things, and just although one of my favorite things is that they didn't think to reserve enough capacity for the existing population. And then you think about the increase of migration and the additional demands provided by that, and it's even greater. And yeah, it's a mess.
Yep, absolutely. And just to remind everybody that the gas price, which is relatively high and, almost exposed to the international price, feeds back then into the electricity prices, which feeds back then into inflation directly and also indirectly. So that this is another reason why, as I said earlier on, inflation in Australia is now fundamentally driven not by international factors, but predominantly by bad policy over the last decade plus.
100%. And I'd also just add as well that the electricity subsidies and the way that they were implemented differently in different states is going to see the impact of the rise in electricity prices, which was somewhat muted by the subsidies in the Q3 CPI. Well, that's going to feed in over the next 3 quarters. So we're going to see the delayed impact of rising electricity prices, which is going to keep in, which is going to help keep inflation higher than it otherwise would have been, all the way into 2024, into Q3, until we see those differing wholesale electricity prices feed into the CPI next year.
Yeah, and just quickly, in the UK, they just announced the next price. They sort of have price settings for 3 month periods in the UK for energy. And they've actually announced a 5% increase. Now, prices came down last year, but last year they actually had a significant subsidy. This year there isn't a subsidy. So in absolute terms, people are now going to pay more for their energy than they did this time last year. So think about that in terms of the So think about that in terms of the impact on inflation. So, you know, you can see how inflation is now going to be building again around energy because energy has gone up by 5%. So it shows you that if you start intervening and trying to fix one problem, you can actually create another problem or delay a problem, but it doesn't necessarily solve anything.
Well, you know, intervening and then making the problem worse is, well, admittedly, this doesn't make the problem worse, but, you know, intervening and making the problem worse in other instances is just something that the government likes to do here, at least when it comes to the housing market anyway.
Yeah. Well, it goes to form, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we're going to see more of it, let's be honest. You know, if a state or a territory has the ammunition to do it, they're going to do it, just like Queensland.
Absolutely right. It's the nature of the beast. I want to say, Tarek, thank you for that. Look, two observations. A lot of the issues that we've actually got are not actually just a consequence of COVID. You know, it's a set of structural issues that have been building for a long, long time. Until relatively recently, a lot of this was being masked thanks to the high migration and government intervention and those sorts of things. But I would say that the chickens are now coming home to roost. And I suggest that 2024 is going to be a bit of a sticky year, particularly in Australia, for the reasons we've discussed. I guess the question is, will politicians double down on what they've been doing, or will they wake up and smell the roses and realise they need to actually change trajectory? That, for me now, is the most interesting question of all.
I think they will realise, mostly because their political futures are on the line. But that doesn't mean they're going to make the right decisions, though. They're going to make the required decisions to arrest their, you know, their falls in the polls, or arrest, you know, their falls in terms of, you know, people believing that they're capable of addressing the issues afflicting the nation. Say, for example, I think we are going to see immigration. We're going to see it fall fairly significantly, but it's probably going to end up still significantly higher than it was, than the record high level prior to the pandemic. You know, I think it's going to be, you know, another similar story with the housing issue. I reckon we're probably going to see more first homeowner grants and more cash thrown at the economy in that regard, because they need to be seen as doing something. And for reasons that frankly escape me, the electorate seems to think that that's a good idea. But, you know, it is what it is.
Announceables, mate. Announceables. We need more announceables. Roll them out.
Well, exactly. You know, and you've got the, you know, and the reality is that, you know, Labor thinks that they've got a, you know, that they're up against a bit of a turkey, you know, in terms of, well, pun slightly intended for the day. And, you know, they think that they're going to be able to, you know, to beat Dutton handily, and maybe they will. But if they keep going the way they're going, they're going to erode the support they do have. And while maybe the LNP, you know, well, you know, looking at the polling, you know, perhaps, you know, they probably won't, you know, make a comeback, considering that the huge mountain they have to climb because of the number of independent seats that have been won. You know, it's not hard to see Albanese in minority government.
Yeah, will be interesting. Tarek, I want to say thank you very much. Thanks for stepping away from baby care and coming and talking about economics. I'm glad you did. I look forward to doing the next one with you. And there are so many things to explore. I really appreciate the chance to explore them with you here. It's been very interesting. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no worries, mate. I'm, as always, I'm very glad to be here and looking forward to my next discussion. Perhaps we'll take some questions if I've got the time to answer them.
Look forward to that. Have a good week. See you. Bye-bye.
You too, mate. Bye.